Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We're in desperate need of rebuilding infrastructure, a large dollar ticket item, and covering all, you know, finding jobs for all these people that are unemployed. And so this bank is organized just like Alexander Hamilton's first bank of the United States. We capitalized the bank with private holdings of treasury bonds. That could be anybody's savings account, from a pension fund to a state or local government that has a rainy day fund that they're keeping in treasuries, private corporations, foreign governments, anybody. So that means that this NIB, with respect to the federal budget, will be budget neutral, will not require any new taxes, like a new gas tax or anything like that, and will not create any new federal debt or deficits.
Sounds pretty good, right? Major new money for America's failing infrastructure, with no new taxes and a profit to boot. That was our guest today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Alfeka Matardi of the National Infrastructure Bank Coalition, discussing a rapidly developing new grassroots effort to get America's infrastructure in shape. Hello, and welcome to the program. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's colleague and co-host. In our last program, Ellen spent some time developing the background for a proposed national infrastructure bank, which has been formulated in a new House bill, H.R. 6422. The importance of dealing with America's undertended 20th century infrastructure is getting more critically severe as America falls behind other nations in delivering the safety, services, and efficiencies that are necessary for today's and for tomorrow's world. So today we're going to continue that conversation and take a closer look at the H.R. 6422 bill with Alfeka Matardi and also some of the current federal banking mechanisms that underlie our heretofore stultified government credit resources. The ramifications of taking significant action on infrastructure brings a bright ray of hope, really, for our country, a very promising prospect for America's future. Millions of new jobs, dramatic improvements in environmental and health conditions, and a host of other benefits that are long overdue. Previous concerns about government financing of infrastructure raised the contention that we simply can't afford it, and that huge new debt will saddle our country for future generations. But these concerns have been demonstrated to be ill-founded and driven in part by financial interests that would like to make profits in the sector through new public-private partnerships. The H.R. 6422 bill that we're discussing is none of that. Instead, it builds on a strong, historically American tradition of creating the new money that we need, and doing so profitably. It's an exciting new prospect for our economy and our country, and one that draws from America's great days of recovery and growth in decades and centuries gone by. Ellen talks with Alfeka Matardi about that in a moment. Later in the program, we talked with Dr. Robert Hockett, an expert on the Federal Reserve and an early author of the idea of a national infrastructure bank, a la Alexander Hamilton, who was the first American to devise a banking model that monetizes our credit. So let's get started and talk with Ellen. Ellen, what's coming forward in really on the national stage is a national infrastructure bank movement, a coalition called the NIV Coalition, which is a grassroots-driven movement to create a new national infrastructure bank. And you've got this wonderful conversation, a couple of them coming up in this program, with Alfeka Madarte. And tell us about what the NIB is and how it fits into our current focus on banking.
Yeah, okay. So the National Infrastructure Bank is one of several proposals for an infrastructure bank. This one was HR 6422, and it's got a lot of national support. And one reason, as I will go into in the actual interview, but or she'll go into, one reason is that it's free to the people. In other words, we don't have to go heavily into debt. We need $4 trillion worth of infrastructure, and we can get the money in the same place that Lincoln got it, that Hamilton got it, and more or less that Roosevelt got it. It's a little different model than the infrastructure, than the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. But we'll go into that. Anyway, it's a way of monetizing the public credit in order to pay for infrastructure. So you basically kill two birds with one stone. We've got a massive unemployment problem and a massive infrastructure problem. So obviously all you gotta do is hire the people to build the infrastructure, and you've solved both problems. But then the question is, how do you pay for it? And that's what this bill is all about. You can pay for it without dipping into taxes or going heavily into debt. And then we'll be talking with Bob Hockett about his several papers he's written lately that are about or related to a national infrastructure bank and his insights on the whole thing. So we've got it all figured out if we could just get Congress.
And it's quite interesting to remember that not so long ago when the Trump administration took over that they were going to do a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure financing program. And they were looking at doing it in a public-private partnership. Which have a very murky sort of a history, and a very expensive one too. This is dramatically different. It's a different approach altogether, isn't it? Actually, historically based in our own country.
Yeah, I mean, you still need private companies. You hire the private companies to do different things, but they're under contract from the government, and the government, other than their normal, you know, the profits they need to pay for their workers, the profits go back to the people, or there are no profits, really. It's really a non-profit sort of arrangement.
Well, they were talking about financing, private finance, in the forms of bonds and other.
Yeah, that would be like up to 10%. I saw one place where the bonds were like 10 or 12% for infrastructure. Terrible.
So and once again, we see
2% under these models, yeah.
That the role of, you know, having a public financing agency has great efficiencies and the ability, really an unlimited ability, to invest in our country, which is, as you indicated, so desperately needed. So good. I'm looking forward to hearing these conversations. It's really actually quite an exciting point for us in the public banking movement, because here we're seeing movements of people from a variety of sectors of society coming around toward the idea of having a public financial resource available to them on the federal level, on the state level, and on the local level. And that's kind of what's happening now. So let's go to that interview.
We clearly are in a situation where we need to get more money into the real economy, which means get it to the workers, get it to the small businesses. And this is the way to do it. That's not, I mean, universal basic income is so controversial. We're probably not going to get many more of these payouts from Congress, but they certainly could all agree on a national infrastructure bank, particularly if it's not going to cost them anything. And it solves many of their issues all at once.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go talk to Alfeka. Thanks.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be speaking with Alfeka Madarte, who is an economist with the Coalition for a National Infrastructure Bank. That's a bill that's currently in Congress, H.R. 6422. And so it's great to be speaking with you, Elfeca. I understand there are several bills on, or there have been various proposals for infrastructure banks, but we like this one the best because it's a depository bank, which means it can leverage capital at 10 to 1 and borrow from the Federal Reserve at 0.25%, as all depository banks can in good standing. And it's revenue neutral, which is amazing, the whole idea that it won't cost the taxpayers anything. So can you explain to us how it's structured and how it works and why we can pull this off without money, without new money? I know it's based on the Reconstruction Finance Corporation of the Roosevelt years and the Hamiltonian original model of banking. So if you can go into all that, that would be super. It'd be great interest to our our listeners.
Super. So you are correct. We have had actually four national infrastructure banks in our nation's past. Alexander Hamilton's first bank of the United States was the first one. Then we had a second bank under John Quincy Adams, a third set of banks under Lincoln, President Lincoln, and then FDR's Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And actually, we've built almost all of the nation's infrastructure based on one of these banks. The main problem with financing infrastructure is that we have not been able to do it over the last 70 years through the normal means, which is through the federal budget, through state and local budgets, even municipal bonds or public-private partnerships or any of those things. And now we have a huge backlog of infrastructure that we desperately need to fix and refurbish. So we're now up to this something like $4.6 trillion mark, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. Only maybe less than half of that is financed through the other means. So we have to pick up that. And then we also have to finance things that these engineers don't cover, but we really need, like high-speed rail, which is a big-ticket item, affordable housing, that's a big-ticket item, broadband everywhere we desperately need, and maybe some large water projects. So now our price tag has really gotten up there. And so that's why we're proposing under H.R. 6422 a $4 trillion infrastructure bank. But I would caveat that the price tag might need to get bigger, because now ASCII is coming out with new estimations. They have out three sectors so far, which is transportation, water, and the electricity grid. And their numbers have either doubled or gone up by a factor of, in some cases, tenfold. So we're going to need more. And then add to that the fact that we have a huge now unemployment problem in the United States, a structural unemployment problem, which might not go away even after our economy reopens for COVID. So we're in desperate need of rebuilding infrastructure, a large dollar ticket item, and covering all, you know, finding jobs for all these people that are unemployed. And we can kill two birds with one stone here. So this bank is organized just like Alexander Hamilton's first bank of the United States. We capitalize the bank with private holdings of treasury bonds. That could be anybody's savings account, from a pension fund to a state or local government that has a rainy day fund that they're keeping in treasuries, private corporations, foreign governments, anybody. We only need to in order to capitalize $4 trillion in a deposit money bank, we need about $500 billion in these treasuries. And what we're going to do is entice them, to these depositors, to bring them in and invest them in the bank in exchange for preferred stock that pays an extra 2% above. So 2% of 500 billion, that means we need 10 billion a year for this extra 2%, which we're initially gonna take from the federal budget as mandatory spending, but then we're going to reimburse the government back for it through the interest earnings that the bank earns on its infrastructure loans. So that means that this NIB, with respect to the federal budget, will be budget neutral, will not require any new taxes, like a new gas tax or anything like that, and will not create any new federal debt or deficits. And that's very important in today's world, where all kinds of legislation are backed up in Congress right now over concerns for the federal debt and deficits. And as an economist, I think that there's an important role to play for deficit spending, for stimulus measures to get us out of the V-shaped recession. But over the long run, to finance infrastructure, we have not been able to do it through the normal means of federal budgets, and we really need to find an institution like the National Infrastructure Bank, like the European Investment Bank, for example, which does this in Europe across countries to fund infrastructure, because it needs a long-term, steady-state source of funding. And we can do all of this without adding to federal debts and deficits. And the second thing that's really important about this bank is its scale. So we're talking about $4 trillion, maybe more. And when we go out and spend that much money on infrastructure, we have to hire a whole lot of workers to build the infrastructure directly, and then also to accommodate the pickup in the economy that comes from people having more money in their pockets, who are the workers, and rolling up on the whole size of the economy. So we think that this will create 25 million new great paying jobs, take people off the unemployment rolls that are currently unemployed now, and those jobs, many of them will never come back. In the service sectors and other places, those jobs just won't come back. Those jobs will provide full benefits, like healthcare benefits. The jobs will also provide on-the-job training. Through every means, mechanism and means possible, that is through labor unions that will train in the craft programs, through community colleges, through high school programs, through college programs. We need more engineers. We need a whole set of new education to go with this new infrastructure building. And that'll be a whole endeavor unto itself. But we really think that this will supercharge the American economy, just like the same thing that happened when we had the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was a very large bank. Most people don't know how large that bank was. Actually, the loans outstanding for that bank were greater than all of the loans outstanding for all the commercial banks combined in the United States in 1940. So that's a really large bank. And that bank made money. It made money for the United States government. All the loans were paid back. The bank ended its charter, which ended, you know, by the charter having a sunset clause in it, and ended the bank in the black, as did the other three banks that came before. So this is a great opportunity to really supercharge the American economy, restructure it, lift up all ships at once. It'll be great for American businesses. It'll be great for federal and state and local balance sheets, which will now have more tax revenues coming in due to people having better incomes and paying more income taxes. It will be better for community development programs where we can go in and fix a whole bunch of infrastructure at one time and hire the people that live in that area to build their own new infrastructure, build affordable housing, all these kind of things. So I'm so excited about the program. And then the other thing I wanted to also let you know is that we have a huge grassroots effort in the United States promoting this bank. I'm just astounded by it every time. We're going to have another webinar this week talking about how the bank is good for everyone. Democrats, Republicans, businesses, you know, community development, all those kind of things. We've had webinars in the past talking about how the bank is being promoted, and we're really on a roll all across the United States on this bank.
Okay, that's great. Can you, I mean, I know the answer, but I'm going to ask, can you explain where the bank will get the money? The Reconstruction Finance Corporation, of course, sold bonds and got actual money in return for the bonds. But they got it mostly from the federal government, which didn't have the money either. I mean, they just went into debt. But anyway, can you explain where this money is going to come from?
Certainly. Yeah, as you mentioned, this bank is created as a deposit money bank. And like all deposit money banks, they create money when they give a loan. And you've done a great job on the Wikipedia webpage, I might say, by explaining all this. And I'm surprised that many PhDs in finance and other things don't know about this secret sauce that banks create money when they give a loan. So it's a simple process. Somebody comes in for a loan for, say, $10 million. The bank, because it's a deposit money bank, creates a deposit in their name for $10 million, and on its asset side, puts the loan up on its asset side as a $10 million loan. So assets equal liabilities in the commercial banking depository world. Then when they create this loan and they create the deposit, then the bank will need to, then the owner of the deposit, the borrower, will now need to draw down his deposit over time. And that means that maybe he'll issue a check against it. That check will then go, the money will clear out of that deposit and go into a deposit someplace else. If it goes outside the bank, then the bank can always go for the cash in exchange for that to the Federal Reserve or to its liquidity created on account of other deposits coming in to cover it. So that's essentially what happens when the loan is the principal of the loan is dispersed, and then it charges interest over time. This bank, by the way, because it's a public bank, will charge the rock bottom interest rate because we want to lower financing costs in exchange for being able to pay workers prevailing wages on these projects as the projects are given out. That's the most important thing for this because it's a public bank. So we'll charge the Treasury bond rate or 2% floor. That'll still be cheaper than interest rates that are being charged by public-private partnerships, even federal loan programs like DFIA-WIFIA, or even municipal bonds today. So that's the idea of the bank and where the money comes from.
Yeah, I've seen these public-private partnership proposals or just where they're actually seeking like 10% or 12% interest for the private part. So yeah. Definitely getting gouged. Now, what about, I know the Reconstruction Finance Corporation did self-financing loans that, you know, they only did loans of things that would pay back, like farms and dams and bridges or toll roads, whatever, things that actually generated fees or profits that could pay back the loan. But what do you do about things like sewers and cracks in the road and stuff where you're not generating money directly?
Right. So we looked at the whole panoply of how state and local governments, which own 90% of the nation's infrastructure, finance their infrastructure. And they can do it either through getting a grant from the federal government or issuing a bond or trying to pay for infrastructure projects on a pay-as-you-go basis. For example, they might have raised a gas tax and they're trying to pay on a pay-as-you-go basis for infrastructure. None of that has really worked out very well. But this bank would be very flexible in how it gives loans to these owners of public infrastructure. We want to keep public infrastructure public. We don't want to privatize it any more than is already the case. Now, there might be some projects like public-private partnerships like an airport refurbishment. This has happened up in New York with JFK Airport and LaGuardia Airport, where it makes sense to do a PPP because you have user fees coming in from airline concessions and food concessions in the airport, and that they can pay for it. Okay, that works out really well. But it's not worked out well at all on something like roads, even highways, public highways. We've had several PP, we have a lot of them in Virginia, for example, where I live. And even though a PPP is supposed to provide the money and get a higher interest rate to take on the risk for designing and operating the project, if it bids too low or it doesn't manage well or something, and it can always declare bankruptcy. And then the state winds up owning the thing, taking it over anyway. That's happened to a rail line project in Maryland just this week. Went to courts and they took all their tractors and they went home. So we really have to have a better way to finance for it. Now, it makes sense for state and local governments to do these projects, even whether or not they're earning a user fee, a utility. For the biggest infrastructure that's really behind the eight ball in terms of coverage is water infrastructure. That is drinking water, wastewater, and sewage. And though they do earn user fees, but they have a huge backlog in infrastructure investment because they can't charge enough interest fees. And if they would only have enough to invest. They would recoup more of their money, like 40% water wastage that happens because of cracked pipes, for example. Or and there's a social health problem too. All the lead in the water. All those lead pipes need to be fixed. We have on the East Coast, we have pipes that are wooden pipes that were put in the 1800s, and they're still in operation. So essentially, we need to change every water pipe in the country and refurbish it. And that's a big investment job. And while we're digging up the roads to redo the pipes, we may as well put in the broadband, the electrical wiring, new gas lines, which are also leaking. We may as well bundle all this stuff together to make it a more efficient redevelopment project. And so the bank can handle all of those things. And what we notice is that we did an estimation of what kind of infrastructure spending on the municipal bond side have these owners of infrastructure done in the past. And we found that they already have about $4 trillion in outstanding municipal bonds now. About half of them are paid back through general obligation funds, and the other half through these user fees. And they were in great shape before COVID broke out to take on another $4 trillion. They were in great shape, really, honestly. And what happens when you have all this infrastructure spending going on is it becomes great for their budgets. Now they have people earning higher incomes. They have less people on social safety nets. So their expenses go down, their income goes up, and they are able to reservice these loans just simply through growth. If we can get growth, economic growth in America, from its 1.5% level over the last 10 years up to the 5% level we had the last time we had an infrastructure bank, the RFC, that higher growth rate is a summation indicator for everything being better. Everybody's finances improve, including the state and local governments, who can now repay these loans out of increased revenues and lower expenses.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. You put the people back to work and they'll pay taxes. And then
And now with COVID, it's the only solution for COVID. I mean, if we keep having one stimulus bill after another, we can plug people's income streams, you know, for a short period of time, a few months maybe. But the long-term generation of jobs, which we absolutely desperately need after COVID, because so many jobs will be lost. Mm-hmm. The only way we can have that happen is through a national infrastructure bank to create the jobs.
And that during the 30s, they built so well. I mean, you see those beautiful artistic paintings and the post office with the paintings. I mean, yes. They're just classic buildings.
Yes.
Because they could afford to pay painters and, you know, artists and whatever to. Yeah. So that was great. And it's also modeled on Hamilton's bank. Can you explain what the connection is there?
Sure.
Or even what a Hamiltonian bank is?
Hamilton was our nation's first economist. Actually, the man went out and measured GDP. He wanted to know how much did we produce. I thought that was a fascinating, for a Treasury secretary. He was really our first economist. And he was also fighting from the aftermath of the American Revolution, where the British wanted to still keep us under their thumb and not permit us to industrialize, okay? And he was having none of that. So what he did was, and don't forget, during the American Revolution, the states accumulated a whole lot of debt as a result of fighting the war, okay? And the first inclination for the newly forming government was to repay back all this debt. And Hamilton said, no, let's use the debt. Let's repurpose the debt and let's use it to capitalize the First Bank of the United States, which he did. And actually the plan was not to ever pay back the debt. The plan was only to pay the interest on the debt. And that's what he formulated a whiskey tax for, was to pay this interest on it. Now, they did have a little riot about paying the whiskey tax, but never mind. The whole thing was a huge success. He built the first industrial centers in Paterson, New Jersey. He built roads, canals, bridges. He utilized that debt in order to create an industrialization base and raise up the economy. And then what happened was you grow out of the debt. The same thing happened under under FDR's Reconstruction Finance Corporation. We accumulated a lot of debt for World War II. We never paid back any of it. And we just raised the growth rate so high that we grew out of the debt. When you measure debt, you should always divide it by GDP so that you can compare 1 year with another, of course. And within 1 week, Hamilton raised $10 million through this process of buying debt and putting and investing it in its capital into the bank in 1 week. And then that was the capitalization for him to go get started and invest in infrastructure.
Great. And then you mentioned Lincoln's banks too. I know that the National Bank Act was during Lincoln's tenure, but they actually...
That's what I'm referring to. Lincoln actually ran, when he first ran for president, he ran on a platform of creating a third infrastructure bank in the United States. And then this little niggly thing like the Civil War came along and he got sidetracked. And then they had a sort of meltdown of destruction of all the infrastructure in the United States as a result of the war. And then he had a financial crisis on top of that. So what he had to do was enact the first national banking system. And since he used the same idea from Hamilton of using treasury debt and use it for the swap, for the currency swap, at the time of this crisis, states had issued up to 7,000 different kinds of currencies. And when he wanted to nationalize the bank and have everybody charter their new bank as a national charter, what they needed to do was to swap the old currencies for the new, and then they used the treasuries as a backstop. So it was a little bit of an indirect system compared to the first and second banks, but it was essentially the same thing of using treasury debt to capitalize everything. And then he also used those newly formed banks in order to finance the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yeah, that's great. And I heard it's probably rumor, but that some friend, when he was getting hit with something like 30% interest rates from the British, and some friend said, you know, you don't have to pay that. You can just issue the money. I mean, that's what the American colonists did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's all so interesting. Is there more you'd like to explain?
I think I've covered most of it. I really think that during this COVID world, we really need to bring all the legislation I've mentioned is just jammed up in Congress right now. And of course, there's this tribal look at what we can do to get out of our COVID economic dilemma. And I think that this bank suits itself both to Democrats and Republicans because it does not create new debt. And I really think it's important to bring it to the top of the policy pile as a solution for a medium-term to long-term solution for building infrastructure and creating long-paying, sustainable jobs for everyone across the country.
I think it's brilliant because that is our two biggest problems right now are probably that everybody's out of work, we need the jobs, and we need the infrastructure, and that can kill them both, fix them both without... running up the debt. So that's super. So, and how can people help?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, this is a grassroots effort. We need to nudge our congressmen a little bit. They're so entrenched in their ways that they don't see either Democrat or Republican that there's a way out. And this is a way out. It's been done four times before. So anybody that would be interested to work on this endeavor can go to our website, nibcoalition.com. And there are a whole bunch of papers there explaining how the NIB works, some webinars explaining how the NIB works, and a list of endorsements of all the endorsements we've got across the nation so far. And really the grassroots initiative that we've seen that really, really works is for anybody that's really super interested in getting infrastructure paid for in their area. Suppose that they're a depressed community, for example. They need jobs, they need infrastructure, they need everything. They just, the people in Michigan, for example, are a classic case in point. They blanketed every single county, city government, everything, with draft resolutions, got them all signed, sent them all the way up to the top, even sent them to the White House, but sent them to their congresspersons. And then they got their congresspersons to endorse and co-sponsor the bank. And that's the deal. This can be done. It's all hands on deck, with many hands make for, you know, light work. So I'm really excited. Anybody that needs a job, anybody that wants to see community improvement, to make sure, you know, across the United States, they need to demand of our government officials that we consider this as a very viable policy proposal, and they can help.
That's great. Okay, so it's nibcoalition.com, right?
Yes.
Okay, and Alfeca Mutardi. So
right.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We're privileged to have a number of academic brains in our midst on the Public Banking Institute Advisory Board who give us a chance to use the word polymath when describing their fields of knowledge and their expertise. One of them is our next guest, a recurring visitor here on It's Our Money, Dr. Robert Hockett. Bob Hockett teaches law and economics at Cornell and has worked with the Fed, the IMF, and many notable organizations, as well as being a consultant on the Green New Deal with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and numerous other congressional and public policy influencers. Today, we're talking with Bob about the Federal Reserve's historical and institutional role and background and how it fits into a new matrix for infrastructure finance that America hopefully will be pursuing in coming years. Bob's articulation of the dual roles that our federal central bank must play in managing both our money supply and its appropriate productive allocation is at the heart of how a new development bank should be devised. He's recently penned several articles on the subject, and our conversation with him provides both interesting and illuminating background for understanding how a new infrastructure finance entity could and should emerge. Ellen and I welcomed Bob to the show, and let it roll.
Thank you, guys. It's so great to be on with you again in this particular setting. So quite a few things I put out in the last few months, but the two that maybe are worth focusing on here are first, a big white paper called Spread the Fed, and then second, a big white paper called an FSOC for Continuous Public Investment, the subtitle being a National Reconstruction and Development Commission. Each of these two proposals sort of focuses on one side of a sort of two-sided coin, you might say, when we're talking about productive investment, right? One side of the coin is the private sector side, where private sector parties engage in productive investment, which is to say they invest in new enterprises, new industries, new products, new services that are genuinely productive, right, rather than merely speculative in the sense of betting on price movements in secondary financial markets or tertiary derivatives markets. And then the other side is the public sector side, where many expenditures or maybe investments have to be publicly made rather than merely publicly facilitated, right? So the Fed proposal is in effect about public facilitation of productive rather than speculative private investment. And then the National Reconstruction and Development Commission, or FSOC for National Development or Continuous Public Investment proposal, I'll just call it NRDC, is more about the direct public investing, right? So, but you could say that the private sector side is the industrial side and the public sector side is the infrastructure side. Now, again, that's misleading if one reads that in sort of oversimplified way, but broadly speaking, that's what we're talking about here. So let me just really, really briefly describe each, right? So on the private sector side, this is something I think that Ellen and Walt, you guys know probably much more about than the general public does, just because you guys have made this your part of your life's work for years, long before I sort of got interested in this area. But, you know, the original vision, there's a reason that the Federal Reserve is called the Federal Reserve System, right? We sometimes hear people who don't know better refer to the Federal Reserve Bank, which is not a thing. There's no such thing as the Federal Reserve Bank. There are, on the other hand, there is, first of all, a Federal Reserve Board, and then there are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. And together with the FOMC, or Federal Open Market Committee, as a kind of corpus callosum between the two tiers, they constitute a system, right? A Federal Reserve system. Now, why do we have that? Why did the founders of this system establish it as a system over 100 years ago, back in 1913? Well, it's fairly straightforward, and it's kind of amazing that the history has been forgotten, especially in a country that thinks of itself as a federated republic, right? But the idea was, you know, we went without a central bank for a long time because people were, you know, quite reasonably fearful of the possibility of a concentration of financial and monetary power in the Northeast if we had a central bank in the way that European countries had, right? They didn't want financial power to be concentrated up in New York or Boston or Philadelphia. On the other hand, the 1907 crash made clear that we needed some kind of centralized modulation of credit aggregates economy-wide. So what was the best way to have it both ways? Well, it was essentially to establish something like our Fed, a two-tier system. So on the one hand, we have the regional Federal Reserve banks, which were intended, in effect, to facilitate private sector investment in actual productive, not speculative, activity. These institutions could discount commercial paper, or I should say rediscount commercial paper that was initially discounted by small community banks, banks that functioned, even when in the private sector, a bit like the public banks that we all have been pushing, especially since private sector banks stopped being community banks and started being much more sort of global players. So the idea here then was to assure adequate liquidity for robust private sector investment.
Buying discount, because I think most people don't know what that means.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So basically just means monetize. It means you will buy that paper from the Fed. You will basically swap Federal Reserve notes or their bank account equivalent, so-called fiduciary money, for this private sector money, which is commercial paper, right? I mean, one way to think about a loan or about monetization is simply a swapping for certain intervals of time. If it's a long-term loan, it's a long-term swap of Federal Reserve notes, i.e. dollar bills, for promissory notes, right, that individuals submit when they borrow. If, on the other hand, you are lending on the strength of commercial paper, we don't call those promissory notes, we call it commercial paper of various kinds. And again, you can do this for various terms, right? You can swap for 6 months, you can swap for a year, you can swap for 10 years, or if it's a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, you can swap for 30 years. But in essence, what we're talking about is a swapping of a public sector liability for a private sector liability, namely dollar bills or Federal Reserve notes. So in effect, one way to think about what a central bank does, or certainly what our Fed does, and what banks do when they're operating in the way that they're meant to operate, is that they basically facilitate swapping of private promissory notes of various kinds, which are not legal tender, for public promissory notes, i.e. dollar bills or their fiduciary bank account equivalent, which are public promissory notes, which are legal tender. And that's essentially what monetization is. And so what we were really envisaging with the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, I say we as if I were there, what we as a polity were envisaging was a kind of ongoing public sector monetization or facilitation of monetization of private sector obligations. And the criteria for access to the so-called discount window, which is what we called the place, the figurative place where you would do that swapping, the criteria themselves sounded in actual productive investment, right? In other words, you couldn't go to your regional Federal Reserve Bank and say, hey, I've got a great money-making idea. I've figured out how the slot machines in Vegas work. If I can just borrow $100, I can go to Vegas with it and come back with $100,000. That's profitable, so you guys should be cool with that. We didn't go for that, right? Because we didn't work on just profits alone. We worked on productive profitability, not just profitability simpliciter. Of course, the secret of financialization, the thing that makes contemporary financialization possible, is precisely the fact that secondary and tertiary markets are so overdeveloped relative to primary markets that profitability and production have been severed, which isn't to say that you can't profit by being productive. It's just to say that there are many more ways to be profitable without being productive. And insofar as we lend public money on the strength of profitability alone, rather than insisting on productive profitability, we get lots of public money flowing into speculative markets, which then drive up asset prices. Back when we insisted on productive investment as a sort of condition before public money would be made available, we didn't have financialization of that sort because we looked at production, not just profitability. So that's on the private sector side. So the Federal Reserve Board at the top of the system, you can think of as a kind of coordinator, right? The top tier there is meant to coordinate all of the 12 institutions in the second tier or the lower tier. And the idea here is to make sure that you have a sort of balance of credit growth economy-wide. It's to make sure that you don't have sort of an excess of credit flow to some sectors of the country or some regions of the country over others. The way I sort of try to distinguish between these two roles then is I say there's a modulatory task, which is to make sure that there's not too much or too little credit money out there. And then there's an allocative task, which is to make sure the money's flowing in the right ways. And while these are conceptually or analytically distinct functions, they are practically joined at the hip. You can't do one without the other. If you're not getting allocation right, you're not going to get modulation right. And another way then to characterize what's gone wrong over the last 50 or 70 years is to say that we've basically completely dispensed with the allocative function that the Federal Reserve regional banks used to perform, yet we've left the modulatory function with the Fed board, which it can't possibly do right or well without getting the allocation right. And in a way, that's sort of a slogan for what's gone wrong, is what we've done is we've been trying to do modulation without allocation over the last 50 years. And the Federal Reserve Act was written by people who understood that you couldn't do one without the other. And that's why you have the regional banks that do allocation, and then the board that does modulation along with the Open Market Committee.
It's fascinating to listen to you go through this articulation of the architecture of our finance. Right now, we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of investing in the productive economy with an infrastructure bank.
Yes.
The National Infrastructure Bank movement actually has become a movement. It's a grassroots movement called the Coalition behind House Bill 6422, looking at creating a new financial entity. Now, your article about the Fed being a development bank, how do you see the Federal Reserve fitting into that kind of architectural framework in which we want to create a whole new possibility for positive investment into our country? Yeah.
So this is the other side of that coin, right, that I mentioned at the sort of top of our conversation, right? So the other side of the coin, the Fed side of the coin, you can think of as public facilitation of private investment. And hence, you can roughly say that that's about industry. The other side of the coin is direct public investment that's not really about public facilitation of private investment. And then we're talking, roughly speaking, about infrastructure rather than industry. So the National Infrastructure Bank movement is focused on that side of the coin. And as a part of that movement, I'm focused on that side as well. I happen to think it's best to do both, but to focus on that public sector side for a moment. Here's the mistake, I think. Isn't it funny? This is all about mistakes. The big mistake that we've made on that side of the coin, I think, in sort of cultural and political terms, is, you know, somewhere along the line, we got the notion that development is a kind of one-off thing, right? You start as an underdeveloped or a lesser developed country, an LDC, then you go through this magic process called development, et voila, now you're developed and it's all done. It's as though you flipped the switch, right? You know, the switch was off, you flip it on, now you're developed and that's all you need. That's ridiculous. Development is forever, right? Whereas our friend Bob Dylan might have put it, he not busy being born is busy dying. In other words, development is lifelong, just like learning is lifelong, just like education is lifelong, and maybe more directly to the present point, just like technology is lifelong. Technological development is always underway. And if you think about it, national development is basically kind of shorthand for national technological development. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, to some extent, of course, that kind of ongoing development can be handled by the private sector. That's what good startups do. But a lot of what needs doing has to be done collectively, right? Because there are certain coordination problems and collective action predicaments that afflict private ordering or decentralized market behavior. And when you have collective action predicaments of this sort, you have to exercise collective agency to address them or to solve them, right? And we have a word for collective agents, or at least we used to. We used to call them governments, right? And before government became a swear word, thanks to everybody's hero, Ronald Reagan, who was a complete moron and probably did more to destroy this country over the last 50 years than just about anybody, thanks to this kind of weird ideology that he propagated, we've gotten into this kind of crazy notion. We have this crazy idea that the government is somehow the enemy, even though the government is the one that's defending you against invasion, and the government is going to build the Great Wall to protect you against all those terrible drug dealer immigrants and so forth. I don't know how people are able coherently to keep, you know, in their heads the same, the thought that on the one hand we need a military, but on the other hand the government is the enemy. But anyway, getting back to the point here, there are lots of collective action predicaments that really do afflict national development as an ongoing national project, right? Think about all of the private sector investment in productive infrastructure that doesn't happen precisely because private sector parties cannot capture the gains that are there to be had through productive infrastructure. And what's funny about this, of course, is that you don't even have to be a heterodox economist to understand that. All of this is entirely accessible even to orthodox economic intuition, but for some reason, even the orthodox economists don't seem to get it, right? This is sort of classic market failure stuff that we're talking about in part. So the NRDC proposal that I've made is it says, look, what we need to do is we need a national development policy that ought to be revisited and renewed on a regular basis, just like the Department of Defense every year puts out a national defense assessment, right? And that national defense assessment is re-examined every year and updated on a regular basis. The thought being that if a country is going to be in sort of an optimal defense posture, it has to take account of changes out there in the world. It has to be able to sort of deal with things that are kind of different today than they were yesterday, right? And we don't leave that to the private sector. We don't just sort of hope that, I don't know, the Boeing Corporation and some private militias will be sort of following global developments and then determining national defense policy on an annual basis and updating it on that basis. Why should we do that with national development? And indeed, countries that don't do it the way we do it the way we used to do it. And what's interesting is the countries that do it the way we used to do it do well, just as we used to do. So METI in Japan, of course, is directly inspired by Alexander Hamilton's First Bank of the U.S., which was a national infrastructure bank as well as a money-issuing central bank. And Germany's great miracle, the late 19th century and ever after, was all sort of overseen and advocated by Friedrich Liest, who was sort of the national economist, in a sense, in the late 19th century. And Liest was constantly quoting Hamilton and referred to himself forthrightly as a Hamiltonian. Now, we don't have to do that if we don't want to be nerdy or whatever, although we can certainly capitalize on current Hamilton mania thanks to Broadway. But, you know, we don't have to worry about being, you know, Hamiltonian about it by, in the sense of using that word, but we really ought to wise up again and understand that there's a reason that Hamilton and then all sorts of other sort of prophets of national development in lots of countries across the world understood development to be a lifelong, continuous, never-ending process. And you need an institution that does that. So what the NRDC that I propose does is it brings together all of the distinct cabinet-level agencies of the federal executive, right? Okay. Just as FSOC brings together all of the financial regulators so that we don't silo financial regulation any longer as we did before 2010, so would this stop us siloing national development or siloing infrastructure by bringing together the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Education, every cabinet level agency that has anything to do with infrastructure or jurisdiction over some industrial domain, brought together to craft a common national development policy that they regularly update in light of new information, and also then to determine the flows of public funds that are appropriated and spent by the Treasury toward coherent national infrastructure projects. And in effect, this would be a kind of a revival of course, the great Reconstruction Finance Corporation of the New Deal era, the great War Finance Corporation of the Wilson era, and our own Hamiltonian First Bank of the U.S., and then the Gallatinian Second Bank of the U.S. Here's the easiest way to do it, I think, you guys. The simplest way to do it is to analogize the National Infrastructure Bank to the regional Federal Reserve banks, and then look at the Fed and then an NRDC, right? And the Fed chair would sit on the NRDC, as would the Treasury Secretary. They both sit on FSOC too, by the way. They would sit on that. And in effect, what you would have is coordination at the top level by Fed, Treasury, and all of these other cabinet level entities on the one hand in the form of the NRDC. They would be coordinating the flows nationwide. And then the Federal Reserve regional banks would be operating at the regional level, mm-hmm. essentially, again, to publicly facilitate these private productive investments. And then we would add, ideally, another layer between the regional Fed banks and firms, businesses, the private sector. That would be, of course, the public banks that we've been pushing. So in the way that, you know, in the same way that, you know, if you look at the U.S. courts, for the federal courts, you've got circuit courts, right? The courts of appeals in different regions. And then you've got federal district courts in each state. And indeed, oftentimes you have more than one in a state because there are different districts in a state. If we were to sort of roughly analogize to that, we'd say, okay, well, look, the Supreme Court in this realm, in effect, would be the NRDC with the Fed and Treasury, of course, on it. The sort of appellate courts would be the regional Fed banks, and then the district courts would be state level or even city level public banks of the kind that we've been pushing. Uh-huh. Now, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, it might not have been as necessary for us to push what we push because there actually was such a thing as a community bank. There were locally oriented banks. And indeed, we even legally required them to be that way, as Ellen will remember, in particular as a banking lawyer, in the form of branching restrictions and interstate banking restrictions and so forth, all of which we tossed off in the late 1990s during those wonderful Clinton years. Another great hero, another great American hero, Bill Clinton. Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, I have to say, must have done more than just about any other two people in the world to sort of mess up our basic economic arrangements over the second half of the 20th century. And yeah. In many ways, I think our task is kind of to undo what those guys did while also addressing the legitimate problems that they took themselves to be responding to and that they simply were responding to in rather, you know, ill-educated ways, let's say.
That's Dr. Robert Hockett of Cornell with a brief overview for how our federal central bank, the Federal Reserve, might evolve into a new role in support of infrastructure, finance, and development. Our thanks to Bob for being with us again. We'll be spending more time with Bob in coming episodes. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.